Well, go Navy, beat Army, of course. You know, for that one day, we obviously are rivals, but beyond that, we're all warriors before and after that, you know, around the world. So it's a wonderful display of competition that should be modeled by other sports, but of course it's still going to be Go Navy for me.
Seven 20 WGN high atop Chicago in the Skyline studio, and excited to have on the line a decorated veteran, a combat pilot, 40 combat missions in the F-14, F-18, retired from the Navy and now dispensing advice and inspiration to the Fortune 500 folks. We've got Dan Baxter. Dan, welcome to WGN.
Thank you very much, Dan. Happy to be here.
Well, it is a happy time in a bunch of different ways and some different milestones to celebrate. It is the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Navy. When a holiday comes like that, of course, there's, you know, yearly things on the calendar and opportunities for recognition well-deserved. But when you have one as big as this, like, how does that hit someone that's in and around it? How does it hit you?
It's a great question. You know, I didn't realize the importance of it, I think, as early as I should have when I was in the Navy. But the Navy and many other institutions, even outside the military, really, I think, benefit from understanding their traditions and all the people that came before and what they represented. And I think the Navy and the military have the most experience with that, do the best job at honoring the traditions that help give people a sense of pride. And I think, obviously, 250th anniversary is a nice number, but it's also a great opportunity, if I'm a leader and I was still in the military, to really highlight some of those traditions again, you know, when you're in command, to your young people, to give them a sense of pride and purpose that most of them may have signed up for. But if they didn't, one thing I learned is that people who didn't sign up necessarily to, say, quote unquote, serve my country, those people, after they have been led well in the military, will eventually say, well, the reason I enjoy serving now is because of pride of being in the U.S. Navy, or pride in being an American and defending what, you know, what we stand for. So I think it's a great opportunity for people to reflect on what they believe, what they stand in, and what they aspire the country for tomorrow to be.
You look at the advancements that you've had, and you've had a lot of those as far as, you know, on the jet side and the fighter pilot side. You go back 250 years. Do you ever think about that? Maybe, well, what was the Navy like 250 years ago? I guess that, you know, they had obviously ships and boats. Do you ever think back to the humble, I guess, origins of the Navy?
I think people don't know it from all the movies, but, you know, the best leaders and the best military people I've been around are humble. And as many great things as I was afforded to do, I'm constantly reminded both by my peers during my time frame, but also the people from before us. I just feel like they had it tougher and did greater things because of maybe the fortitude, what they were asked to do in a couple of major world wars and other conflicts. And so I think, you know, reflecting back on what I consider, you know, I was a fighter pilot and I did things for 20 years in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places, but to be a quote unquote fighter pilot in World War II, my goodness, you know, that's very humbling. And so yeah. I think it's good to reflect back on those sorts of things so that you don't maybe get too big for your britches, as they would say, you know, growing up in the South, because humility is a powerful component of high performance that we really focused on in military aviation, despite what the movies say.
Well, but in those situations, I think some of the teachable moments from that is those are times when the country came together. I think now maybe more than ever before, is we need to really reflect back on what brings us together, what we have in common. And oftentimes it's our men and women in uniform. And you took that choice early on, and you mentioned some of the opportunities that you've afforded, some pretty exclusive, to have an opportunity to be at the Naval Academy and that journey. And for people hearing, or maybe they have, you know, kids or relatives that are maybe looking for or aspiring towards something like that, people always wonder, well, how did that happen? It isn't the kind of thing that you can just want to do and then do. There's a lot of things that have to come into play. And for you, Dan, as far as the Naval Academy, was that always something that was your target, that was something that you aspired to do? Or was it something that just happened and really worked out well?
It's probably the latter of the two for me. Most of the people who do get into the Naval Academy, because it's so selective that they're only taking about 1,200 per year, I think, to, in any one service academy. I think each year the service academies rank in at least the top 3 to 5 on selection criteria. How many people apply to how many are selected. For me, I grew up the only son of a single immigrant young mother who had really modeled, hey, hard work and education are the only ways out to live the American dream, and it's up to you to kind of go get after it. And she did an amazing job working to make that opportunities available to me. So by the time I had the opportunity after 4 years of military high school, which was all the money she had, so I needed to be able to pay for college on my own because she'd somewhat done that just in the high school regime. I was looking at either 4 years of ROTC at a normal university or going to a service academy. And I was lucky enough to get an appointment to all three service academies, Air Force Academy, West Point, and Naval Academy. And really, my main goal was, my mom had always said as an immigrant that America was the greatest country and that you should be willing to serve it. But at the same time, I would say selfishly, as a young man, I was just trying to get off the payroll so my mom didn't have to work three jobs. And so the Naval Academy, unlike an ROTC scholarship, really afforded me the opportunity to 100% tell my mom, I'm good. You don't have to keep working yourself to the bone. And so I was lucky enough to, I think, do all the right things in high school to create what I would say. I was never the best at anything, when you look at the other people that show up at the Naval Academy, but I was above average in all the things that, in a balanced way as a young student. And that was my focus on when I was in high school, was just be better than average at all the things, academics, athletics, military, because I went to the military school. I would say, your temperament, your leadership opportunities that you took advantage of. And so I was able to get into the Naval Academy, and it was a blessing because I learned so much at the Naval Academy about what it means to be successful in a life. Because I tell people the most important thing I learned at the Naval Academy, again, a second time I was going to go through 4 years of military school. The most important thing I learned as I looked around almost week one was that good men and women can be the best and most competitive men and women. And at that point, as a young man, I wasn't so sure. I thought maybe perhaps you had to act a certain way to be eminently successful. And what I found at the Naval Academy, like you probably would find at so many other services academy, is that the best people can be the most successful people. And so that was heartening to me because I'd been raised to be a principled young man, and but yet I wanted to be successful. And the fact that both of those things could be true was really meaningful for me, especially for the rest of my life.
You think about this, you mentioned, and of course, for the listeners, you just wanted to be kind of average, right? At a lot of the different things. And we got to think that you are probably quite a bit higher than average in almost all of those things. Maybe not like a superstar in one thing, but certainly like really great in everything. This is a great opportunity too, to be able to ask why you chose the Naval Academy, because to have an appointment to each one of them, and it couldn't just be about, and we'll get to that, like your choice of being a pilot and all that. You'd think maybe Air Force, of course, Navy has a great history there too, but to have all of those options and to choose Navy, why?
Couple of reasons. One, I had thought if I did want to fly, I had always heard that the hardest thing to do was to land on an aircraft carrier. And one of my decision profiles in life is always pick the hardest thing to do because there's not as many people on that pathway. There's less traffic, if you will, and usually the payoff is greater. And so that, plus I didn't really know anybody west of the Mississippi. I still was a small town kid on the East Coast, and most of my network, I didn't really have any family other than my mom, was all on the East Coast. So, and then if you just look at the Naval Academy, if anyone who has an idea of where would you like to go to school, The location of the Naval Academy is very appealing, especially compared to West Point. I think when I went and visited West Point, it was as gray as it possibly could be, which is only West Point could be as gray as the color gray. And also, I would say, to be fair, Valley Forge Military Academy, where I went to military high school, was very more closely akin to West Point. And while I did very well there, I felt like I wanted something different. And one thing I loved about the Naval Academy was I knew that when you got commissioned, you could either go in the Navy or the Marine Corps. So the optionality of what type of service would be available to you seemed to be much greater coming out of the Naval Academy than it did the Air Force Academy or West Point. And so, yeah, I would say it was really about optionality for career. Because at one point I did think perhaps I might go in the Marine Corps. I was a very, what we called in military high school, a very strict individual, which meant very militaristically inclined. Like, I didn't mind the hardship of hard military protocol, which I would say the Marine is best known for. So there was a high likelihood at one point that I thought I may go in the Marines. And so I liked the option.
Well, the uniforms are great. And if for the listeners too, we'll have pictures up at WGNradio.com. The campus is beautiful. A visitor and tourism bureau basis. It is a really incredible place to be, to see the community around it. It is a lot nicer having been to, you know, all the places, right? And you mentioned West Point being gray. It's even on a sunny day, it's just completely made of stone and gray, and it's kind of isolated. It is a beautiful area too, but I could see the appeal of Annapolis and all of that as well. When it comes to and you mentioned, you know, the challenges, right? Hey, it's hard to land on an aircraft carrier. Was that something going in that you wanted to do? You wanted to be a pilot right away? You knew that this would afford you that path to be able to do that? Was that something? Or did you get there like a lot of kids do, and then you have all of these opportunities and one just clicks?
Well, I certainly, if you look at the timing, you know, I graduated high school in 89, and I was definitely part of that. I definitely was part of that Top Gun generation. So yeah. Any young man who wanted adventure, who wasn't influenced by that movie, probably didn't have a heartbeat or a pulse. So I always thought that might be something that would be interesting. But I would just tell you, as a young man who knew nothing about aviation, I couldn't even tell you if I knew that was even truly an option for me. I think going in, I remember my first year at the Naval Academy thinking that I was actually going to go be a Marine Corps infantry officer. Because again, I love to lead, you know, I love to lead kind of in the trenches. That was the mentality I had when I was in military high school. I love the enlisted sort of mindset. You know, I come from a very blue collar, humble background. And so I thought that's where I really belong, you know, in the trenches with the men and women. And what I wanted to do in the Marines, maybe I was a little misguided. I found that out my second year, and I thought, well, I wonder if I could be a Navy SEAL, but, you know, I'm from the South. I'm not a very good swimmer, and I don't do well in cold weather, and I don't have the quit button. And I thought those are really bad recipes to ever try to be a Navy SEAL, because if you won't quit and the things they use to attract you are to basically drown you and freeze you to death, I have a pretty good idea of how that's going to go. And so maybe that's, you know, like Clint Eastwood said, a man's got to know his limitations. And so I thought, well, I took the, I think it was called at the time, the AQT FAR, which was essentially your aviation aptitude test, you know, battery of testing. And while I didn't, you know, set any land speed records on my scoring with that, the one thing I did essentially max out was the character profile of being an aviator. And I thought, okay, well, you know, obviously I'm going to have to work hard, but they're telling me that I fit the profile for aviation. So I definitely should consider that. And it was, you know, the Navy has a remarkable way of, I think, eventually putting people where they're supposed to be. And if you have the right attitude, wherever you land, you can make the most out of it and probably feel like that's where you're supposed to be. I think you kind of own that no matter if you're in the military or not. And I somehow landed in the perfect community, which allowed me to be perfectly myself, which I'm a hyper competitive human being. And the one thing I loved about Naval Aviation is I didn't have to apologize for being overly competitive like you might outside of a community that really values that. And so that was wonderful for me because I could kind of unleash myself.
to have that validated, I think is really important to have it validated by them, those people who know, right, and say, hey, we don't necessarily care exactly what you think you may be good at or whatever. We know based on what it is that we do in our assessments that this is the place for you. And you got to think, how did that feel when that was what you were kind of just assigned to do, is like, this is what you're going to be? Because I got to tell you, I'm sure the listeners would agree, you know, as far as business card, maybe like heavyweight champion of the world, or maybe, you know, I don't know what else could be in there. Astronaut, right? But fighter pilot, that's pretty cool. So walking into a situation, you know, hey, I'm a plumber, what do you do? It's like, oh, I'm a fighter pilot. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I would tell you, I always felt I'm a very confident human being, but, you know, I grew up from very humble beginnings. And so I was never really that person who would go walking around, oh, yeah, I'm a fighter pilot, naval aviator, you know, kind of like you see in the movies.
Yeah.
You know, I think most of the time when people say, what do you do? I say, oh, I'm an officer in the Navy. And, oh, well, but what do you do in the Navy? And, you know, I would say, well, I fly planes. They're like, okay, well, what kind of planes? I'm like, oh, I have the honor of flying fighter jets, you know, for the Navy. And they're like, well, why didn't you just lead with that? And I'm like, because that's, it felt uncomfortable for me, because it is, to me, even when I was in it, it's a bit of a dream for a young man who desires adventure, doing hard, meaningful things. But there's a lot of people who don't make it. I mean, it's a, you know, I've always wanted to go back and do the attrition mathematics on, you know, what were really the odds of how I got there and where I eventually ended at my career. And, you know, I've done the back of the napkin math, and it's less than like 1%. And I'm thinking, boy, you know, my goodness, Dan, you're more lucky than good. So just be thankful. I just don't have a lot of, any fighter pilot who thinks too much of themselves usually doesn't last very long, or they get fairly well ridiculed, because there's a difference between confidence and ego. And so it is great, honestly. I mean, I love it. And I was so happy to do it, and so honored to do it. But I think you have to be humble about it, because if you're humble, then people will really respect what it is you do. No one respects someone who's pompous, no matter what it is they do or how good they're at it, at least in the world I live in. I'm sure there are sects of the world where that isn't true. But no, I think you have to be humble, and perhaps maybe people are more impressed with your humility than perhaps what you did.
You wonder why that is, and people will wonder what, but I think it's probably the journey. You just, all of those things that take you from point A to point in the cockpit, that takes you through that, that shapes the person, that weeds out and vets the people that would not be fitted for that. And I think maybe that humility, or just maybe that, like an accurate or just a humble sense of self, is really one of the maybe intangibles that are built into it, because it's pretty universal. You don't have a lot of people who've gone through everything to get to the point you are that have, you know, that different kind of, you know, negative personality profile. I wanted to ask this as things come into play. Family-wise, right? As you get a little 20 years in, you have all that kind of stuff. Obviously, your mom happy that you were able to take care of it, right? And then you had an aspirational education, and it was taken care of. But I saw the pictures of you and, you know, getting married right there at the chapel, right, with your wife and your family, and doing what it is that you do, as cool as it is. And part of the reason probably that it is that cool is there's that element, undeniable element of danger. You talk about that as you got a little bit further, you maybe had other people consider, certainly, you know, your wife and a family. Did those things come into play, or do you compartmentalize and just say, hey, they know what they got themselves into?
That's a great question. I would say I think I only cared about, call it, my health, or, you know, whether or not I was in danger, only because of how it would affect the people that loved me. It never really bothered me. For me, I thought, well, if I don't survive this, or if something were to happen, I just want to make sure that I didn't make a mistake that cost somebody else their lives that was innocent, you know. But if it's just me, not a big deal, you know. And then when I got a family, I'm like, well, I just need to make sure that I don't do anything that would besmirch our family or anything like that. But I will tell you that there were, you know, my wife, I don't know if we joke about it anymore. I don't think it's very funny to her, but, you know, I've now been out of the military. I retired in 13. We'll be socializing. She's like, oh, I haven't heard that story before. And it's usually like a story that's creeped out, like where I was probably in a bad position, or maybe it was a close call. And I, you know, I think there was a bit of, I didn't keep things from my wife. She was pretty well informed, but I chose not to increase the undue wear and tear on her heart or her soul about having to worry about me. Because I mean, and my kids asked me, why didn't you push us to go into the military? And I said, well, there's, you know, first off, I think it's a parent's role to empower and then support. But also, I remember how many, call it billions of a second away I've been from dying and how many times that's been. And so something happens to your kid, you want it to be because they were doing something that they chose, that they loved, not something you unduly influenced them towards. And so I would just say, yeah, it's tough on the family. My wife was a great servant to this nation because of the things that she took on as essentially a single parent when I was gone for very long periods of times, many, many times throughout the, you know, the 20 years that my career. I mean, today happens to be the 31st anniversary, you know, for my wife and I.
Yep.
And so she served the nation honorably. By the way, she supported spouses when we were back. By the way, she supported myself, and she raised our three children. So I think all young men should seek great adventure and great hardship so that it builds their character and so that they build great friendships and camaraderie. And that's what the military can do really well for you. And I certainly got that in spades. And I would say I've always feared a life not lived well more than I've, you know, feared my life ending early. So kind of be bold, be brief, be gone. I'd much rather be known for that. Mm-hmm. If you're in the military, if you do wind up sacrificing, you hope it's because there was a purposeful cause to it and not just a mistake. And that's why you train very hard.
Well, for sure. And of course, the spouses and the family, they serve too, in a lot of ways and in very meaningful ways in that support system as well. I wanted to, you know, before we go, we definitely have to talk about this. And here's something that is universal. Of course, everybody can imagine that people that go to a service academy and then excel and get to the point where they're doing amazing things, you know, that they are succeeding in that chosen career on the military side. One thing that is unique, but is pretty universal, is that people that graduate from the service academies, whether it's the Air Force Academy, West Point, Annapolis, is that they are some of the best prepared people for the corporate world. They're out there, you know, owning sports teams, leading Fortune 500 corporations. People may wonder, well, geez, what did they learn being a fighter pilot that allowed them to go ahead and do that? Or what did they learn, you know, driving a tank or artillery or whatever that leads to corporate success? And I think because they describe those institutions oftentimes, not necessarily as colleges, but leadership institutions, right? And they're giving you leadership, which can be universal, useful, and helpful, of course, in a lot of different settings. And you have transitioned since you've retired to where you're sharing some of those lessons, probably some universal truths or some life lessons, certainly some inspiration. How do you do that, Dan? And what are things that you kind of impart to the corporate people that is useful for them, helps them be better at what it is that they do by hearing about what you've done?
Great question. So I've consulted for pretty much every type of industry. What initially started out as what you would call like a high risk, high consequence industry, oil and gas or energy, construction, manufacturing, medical, but even some tech. And I would say really any industry, any company applies. And first off, when you consulted to companies that are looking to, say, heighten performance, you know, for some reason, whether, you know, shareholder value, maybe reduce safety incidents, take care of your people, take care of the customers. Everybody believes that their situation is unique. And the reality is it is, because you have a different set of personalities and team members. But some of the things that you need to do are somewhat industry agnostic. And so sometimes the solutions are very similar. You just have to contextualize them for that particular company, that particular industry, you know, at that particular time, whatever it is they're dealing with. And so from the military, one of the biggest things I noticed is most corporations don't do like we did in the military. So when you're at the Naval Academy, you're taught leadership. They have an entire department on leadership, and you're told, hey, you will lead men and women. You will lead men and women. And so when you start your career, there's two parts to your career. There's two parallel tracks. One is your technical competency, in my case, a pilot, and the other is your leadership pathway. And you start out with less responsibility than ideally you end with, but you have to do both well, and both are career enhancing or career ending. So if you're the best leader, but you're not a very good pilot, you're probably not going to last very long in naval aviation. If you're a great pilot but a terrible leader, you're, similarly not going to last very long with a career. You may not even make it to your 20 years. So unlike most corporations that wait to about year 15 to then say, oh, we should teach leadership to our people that have,
Yes.
rose to the occasion and perhaps deserve it. And the reality is, for 15 years, those people have either been leading well by happenstance, maybe they're natural leaders, or maybe they've burned a bunch of people to the ground and, climbed on the backs of people inappropriately to get to where they are. So I think that's one of the biggest things that wherever we go, we will really try to institutionalize and inculcate, I would say, a parallel leadership kind of career path or continuum in a company, and show them the value, the difference between management and leadership. And that's a very great differentiator, because all things that you want to accomplish come through great leadership, whether it's in the military or out. The other thing that we work on and that we certainly learned was, team performance, team behaviors. And so the behaviors of how people work well together. That's why I think one of the biggest applicant best practices that you can do when you're trying to get into a service academy or an ROTC is they're looking for folks who've played sports, especially team sports, and perhaps even been a leader in those team sports, because you have to be able to learn to win well and fail well with a team. And so team behaviors is something that translates well, and there's a lot of opportunity in the outside world, because perhaps many of those people didn't grow up understanding the value or even becoming very good at being a team member. Some have, but many have not. And then the last is, I was actually coming up with, someone asked me, what were some of the things that represented high performance that helped you be good in naval aviation? And so I've been, as you know, I think, Dane, starting my doctorate in industrial organizational psychology. And so I'm
Nice.
doing a lot of reflecting on, what does it mean to be able to build a high performance team? And I would say some of the things that we've done in our work and consulting, but I would say that I look for in organizations is, in the military, we had what I call a high agency of standards, a lot of standards, SOPs, professional qualifications, standards, procedures, checklists, guidelines. And when you have everybody believing and understanding and knowing and utilizing those, people can do complex things because they free up their brain to be able to do it. And then we also had ongoing continuous embedded training. So you're constantly upskilling and cross-training. And so that's something that translates well and helps the organization. And then a lot of the work I've done is, a lot of organizations believe this kind of underlying principle of time is money. And so they don't spend a lot of time reflecting on what they could have done better. They don't have a great debrief culture, but yet probably the number one discriminator of performance in naval aviation was that we always took time, even in combat, to reflect on what we could have done better. And that's where humility, professional humility, comes in. And so that is a great opportunity for most organizations, is how do you do that well in a way that people look forward to that sort of reflective performance capability. And there's a couple other things, I won't belabor it here, but those are some of the things that I have found that serve well. And I would just say, personal habits wise, a veteran is well serviced to be successful in most organizations once they leave the military, because they know how to show up on time, they know how to conduct themselves appropriately, they know how to learn the environment that they're around them. And I would tell you that that person probably goes home and is obsessing over dinner how they could be better tomorrow. Whereas I think a lot of people check out, perhaps, and aren't fully committed to the organization. And when organizations come to me and say, we'd love to learn how to hire veterans better, we don't have a great track record, one of the questions I'll ask them is, how much training have you done for your leaders to be able to lead a military person well.
Yep.
Because a military person wants to be led well and has an expectation of what great leadership is going to look like. And if you hire them and after 6 months they look up and realize that that doesn't exist, they may not stay long.
Dan, that's just crazy when you think about it. But I'm sure that that is basically the norm, is that you said leadership by happenstance, right? You get people that get off to a point, either they do or they don't, and they're either like burning bridges and just not doing things effectively, or they're just accidentally being good at it, meaning that if they would be much better if they had a little structure and a little guidance along the way. But to build in maybe systems, maybe some sort of definable metrics for success, right? And then people, just to give people the tools, how do you choose the companies that you choose to advise? Is can any company benefit from what it is that you're doing, or are there ones where you're like, yeah, maybe this is a better fit than others?
I would say, because we've served a lot of companies in different industries, we won't say, yeah, that's not a good fit. Now, there may be, depending on what they're trying to accomplish, a price point for any, you know, everybody knows that if you're bringing outside agency out, there is a cost, but not just monetary, it's time. Like, do your people have the ability to take on leading change inside your organization? And so sometimes, you know, as you go out and maybe the only thing you wind up doing is just giving them a roadmap of what it is they need to do versus actually helping them do it. I would say what I really enjoy about the work I've done, and I think this is somewhat unique, is if you look at how organizational performance consulting in general, most companies only will embed themselves at kind of the executive level, and the people they hire can really only perhaps even understand that small segment of it. And so a lot of the work I do is everyone in our company has the ability to meaningfully implement or integrate from the C-suite all the way down to the person who just got hired at the lowest level in the company. And those folks will tell us how it's going, and they'll trust us. And so I think that is the really fun part. It's like, you know, when I was in the military, I spent a lot of time on the deck plates with the sailors, finding out what ground truth was so that I could understand, hey, I said this, here's what I expected, but how did it explode on impact, good or bad, with my people, and what can I do about it? And so I think what I really enjoy is helping organizations be so successful that the only problem they have is attracting the right new people and finding out exactly which promotions to give to the people who've earned it in their organization. So, you know, I like high performance. I like helping people realize their own quote unquote American dream, both personally and professionally. And so outside of just the work I do, I volunteer and mentor a lot of, especially veterans, but I'll mentor anybody who comes across, but I focus on veterans. Because I would just say it's very difficult, even with a resume like I had coming out of the military. I had a lot of people say, I love your resume, I just don't know what to do with you. And as a veteran at that time, that usually translated into no job offer. Right. And so there's a lot more organizations and there's a lot more understanding of what value veterans bring today than there was. But I would still tell you that companies still aren't utilizing the value of a veteran who can very quickly in short order pick up on anything and deliver at a high level. And really, for the amount of pay that you probably can pay them, they will feel like they've won the lottery and be blessed in a lot of these corporations. So I'm a real big advocate of mentoring people to find a way to change the way they see the world from a military lens to a civilian one so they could be successful. Because it is true, sometimes veterans can be their own worst enemy, but they need another veteran to tell them that so that they don't make a mistake when they get an opportunity in the civilian world.
I see the skill set, though, that they're automatically built, that they come with, already allows them to be, like I said, if used properly, and of course, if you know all the factors align there, to be just a great asset to any company. Of course, yourself with everything that you've done for the country, and then transcending that into the corporate world as well, and helping business and companies run better, be more profitable, be more successful, be happier, all that kind of stuff, dispensing it in a bunch of different ways. And Dan, before we let you go, like, if people want to get more information about what it is that you do, how to get in touch, you mentioned that you'll mentor anyone. And so I think that there's maybe some people out there that would want to take you up on it, or companies that would want to get involved with what it is you do. Where can they go?
So you can, you know, the company is Spartan Training and Performance, but If you want to email me directly, you can email me at my call sign, Euchre, as in Bob Euchre, UECKER, at Spartan TP for training and performance, all one word, SpartanTP.com. And so if I can't help you, you know, one of the things I love doing is connecting people with someone who might be able to help you. And so the last thing I would like to say is, and it can be for anybody, but a really call to people who love veterans and to veterans themselves, you should have a goal every year of helping somebody, perhaps a veteran, finding meaningful next mission successfully in the next organization. Because don't assume just because someone's a great person and has a great resume, how hard it's going to be to find a job that's going to be a great fit for veterans. And so I spend a lot of my free time volunteering to do that. And I would implore others to do the same, because, you know, there's nothing better than you can do to help somebody find a way to support their family and, you know, maybe create generational success for their kids that they're trying to raise.
Well, we thank you for your continued service. And of course, we'll have links up at WGNradio.com. And when it comes to Euchre, sorry for your loss. Obviously, we lost Bob Euchre, so many people in the area and the listening audience too, obviously an icon in Milwaukee. And so when it comes to sort of wins and losses, last thing, did you want to make a prediction? The big Army-Navy game comes up. It is America's game. It brings those two great, oftentimes throughout history, they haven't both been great teams. Last year, they were both pretty good. This year, you know, Army's hit some snags and Navy is about as good as they've been. Just your thoughts, any predictions?
Well, go Navy, beat Army, of course. And, you know, sorry, Dane, you know, I told you when you were trying to get your son to go to West Point that we would be friends, but of course, it's still going to be go Navy for me. And all that, you know, for that one day, we obviously are rivals, but beyond that, we're all warriors before and after that, you know, around the world after that. So it's wonderful display of competition that should be modeled by other sports, by other NCAA teams, in my opinion, just especially the way they sing together after the game. And so I'm excited for it. I was there, got to see Navy beat up on Air Force, and that, of course, made my heart swell with pride. And so hopefully we'll see the same thing here in December. But thank you very much for the opportunity. I wish everybody well, and it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting. Thanks again so much, Dan, for your service and, of course, for being on the show today.
Thank you. Cheers.